So welcome to this episode of Monks in Cyberspace. So I'm the only monk here, I think. I'm not sure if there's a Bhante Sujato online or if he's come on perhaps under a pseudonym. It was a bit confusing. I think he originally wanted to join, and I believe he told you he would be joining, but perhaps this is just a lesson in how unreliable the world is, because he's currently in Sri Lanka, and I got a message saying that the internet wasn't good and that he also had a meeting to go to, so you're stuck with me, which could go either way. And so, as usual, we'll have a little bit of chanting, a little bit of meditation, a little bit of dhamma, and perhaps some questions. And so, as always, I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we're meeting here today on the land of the Burramuttigal people of the Darug Nation, and acknowledge that this land was never ceded, that this is stolen land, and that this will always be Aboriginal land. So I acknowledge the elders past, present, and emerging, and pay my respects to all of them, and to extend that gratitude and respect to any First Nations people who are here today or online, and First Nations people everywhere. And so we're going to do the opening ceremony, which is some chanting. So in chanting. So many of you might know these introductory chants that we do traditionally in Buddhist centers, Buddhist temples, Buddhist monasteries. We start off chanting the Namo Tassa three times, and we have the three refuges. And then we chant the Buddha Nusati, the Dhamma Nusati, and the Sangha Nusati, the three jewels of Buddhism. The Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, the teacher, the teachings, and those who followed the teachings to become enlightened. And these are opportunities for us when we chant, not just to tick off a little ritual, a little comforting thing that we do each time, not just because it feels nice or sounds good or feels a bit exotic or feels very Buddhist, but this is an opportunity for us to connect very deeply on an emotional level with the meaning of those words, and to connect with the Buddha, the teacher, to connect with the Dhamma, these teachings, so powerful, so amazing, and to remember that the Sangha of enlightened beings followed those teachings to become enlightened. So these are ways that we can recollect and bring a lot of joy and energy into the mind. So this is why these recollections are placed at the beginning of our ceremonies. We have this idea that it's good to inspire the mind, to uplift the mind before we begin our practice of meditation. It helps put us in the right frame of mind, helps put us in the right place for meditation. Sometimes even just reciting these, reflecting in this way, recollecting these beautiful qualities helps us to develop joy instantly. And we just want to meditate straight away. We feel good. So this is the power of these opening procedures that we do. We shouldn't just take them for granted or want to tick them off or get through them. Each and every time we practice these, it's an opportunity for us to develop these qualities in ourselves. And the Buddha said that when we reflect on these qualities, the path, the Dhamma, is born within us, and our mind, our heart goes straight. We're moving in the direction of the Dhamma. And so these are only positive things that can come from these moments that we practice together as a group. So shall we do that now? Most people, I think, have arrived. So we're going to chant the Namotassa, followed by the three refuges and the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha Anusittis. So if you don't know the words or you don't like doing chanting, you can just sit there and enjoy a Buddhist cultural experience. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami. Iti piso bhagava araham sammā sambuddho vijja charana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasarati sattha deva manusanam Buddho Bhagavati Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Yaridam chattari purisa yugani atta purisa pugala Esa bhagavato savaka sangho Ahuneyo pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anutarang Punyaketang Lokasati. Very good. So hopefully you're feeling uplifted, remembering the beautiful qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and having gone refuge to our teacher and these teachings and the Sangha of enlightened beings. And so I usually like a bit more of an interactive session. So I feel a bit kind of torn between the people in the room and, of course, all you wonderful people online. But one thing I've been doing lately is asking polemic questions. And so perhaps those people who are online can answer in the chat. But for those people in the room, and I'd be interested to hear your response to this polemic question. Is there a correct way to meditate? What do you think? It's a yes or no answer question. Is there a correct way to meditate? So maybe those people online, what do you think? Put your response in the chat. I'm looking for a broad array of views. Is there a correct way to meditate, Michael Holgate? Yes or no question.
Yes.
Yes. Yes and no. Yes, no. What do you think? Yes? What do you think?
No.
No? Yeah. No?
I think not.
No? No. No correct way to meditate.
No.
I think there's many different methods, and if you feel like one's working for you, at least start from there.
Okay, so one of our friends in the room here was saying there's many different ways to meditate, and so if one is working for you. And so I think people have put that in the chat. I noticed most of you weren't people who could follow instructions and just answer yes or no. In a broad sense, yes. So how are we going to reconcile all these yeses and nos and maybes with the people in the room? So perhaps a second question, a follow-up question. Is there incorrect way to meditate? Is there an incorrect way to meditate? Okay, so all those people who said there was no correct way to meditate, you're going to be in a bit of an awkward position here, aren't you?
Yes.
So there are many people here saying online that there are incorrect ways to meditate. What do you think in the room? Yes, incorrect ways. Okay, yeah, so it's tricky, right? So how do we know? How do we know if we're doing the right way or the wrong way?
Isn't it just
an
effective way, not the right or wrong way?
An effective way, yeah, maybe. Yeah, so this is going to be something that will come up from time to time in your meditation practice. And the reason I mention it is because I've been doing a lot of meditation retreats. Almost the past 2 months I've been on retreat. And part of the retreat process is that you meet with people, you have interviews, and you talk to them about their meditation practice. And sometimes people who have been meditating for years will come and they'll say, I have no idea what I'm doing. And they'll say, you know, I've been meditating for years and years and I'm just not sure how to practice. And so this is a bit of a problem, right? Like, we can have these times in our practice where we're just really uncertain, and this doubt, which is a hindrance, gives rise to a lot of problems in our thinking. We have a lot of self-doubt. And then we also have doubts. So we have doubt internally. We also have doubts externally about the teacher and the teachings. And then also internally, that feeling of, I just don't know what I'm doing. I'm not sure how I'm practicing. And so the Buddha was aware of this problem. And that's why we have such explicit instructions and guides as part of the meditation path. And even though it seems to us that those instructions are so brief and not in-depth enough, they're good enough for us to get an insight into, you know, whether our meditation is actually working or not. And so in the whole of the spiritual path, what we want to see is that we're coming out of unwholesome, unskillful, unhelpful, bad qualities or states of mind or thought. And we want to see that we're actually developing wholesome, skillful states, good states. And so from time to time, we might have a little bit of a wobble And certainly in our meditation practice, we can have a little bit of a wobble. In our life also, we can have a little bit of a wobble. But what we want to see is the general trend. Is the general trend improving? And so this is something we can see in the way that we live our life, our interactions with others, our interactions with our perception of ourselves. And it's something that we can also see in our meditation practice. And when you start to see that the mind is inclining more and more towards these positive states, what's actually happening is that we're letting go of those negative states which block or occlude those beautiful states and prevent them from arising. And so we want to encourage those beautiful positive states in our meditation. That's why the Buddha instructed us to meditate with right intention. So this is the way that we can set up our practice, by having a right intention. One of the things that we most grapple with is getting to meditate. There's so many things that prevent us. What are those things? Usually things that are out there in the world that delight us. Sensory pleasures, the excitement of Netflix, the excitement of watching endless TikToks. Welcome. Dinner is going to prevent us from meditating, right? Wanting to listen to music, wanting to be with people, all of these things are going to prevent us from meditating. And we know that, right? It's hard to get to the meditation cushion. And so what we do is we start off with this right intention of renunciation, of voluntarily giving up some of the pleasures from the sense world, moving away from external things and moving internally to the world of our mind. So we're letting go of the outside world. We're letting go of desire to enjoy all of those sensory things out there in the world. It takes an intention to let go. But it's voluntary. No one's forcing it. We do it because we understand that this way will lead to some peace. So this is the first right intention that we need. The second is to have a mind of non-ill will. That's a mind of love. We don't have any hate. We don't have any resentment or anger in our mind when we come to meditate. We just want to be full of kindness to ourselves. So this is very helpful. We don't come to meditation wanting to hurt ourselves to get good results. You know, force yourself, use a lot of willpower, be one of those people who wants to sit really rigid and sit for 3 hours, you know, first thing in the morning, and do it out of a kind of grudge. We don't want to be like that. We don't want to force the mind or hurt the mind. We want to be really gentle and kind. We want to have a mind of non-harm. This is the third right intention, a mind of non-harm. We don't want to harm ourselves or others. And so when we come to meditate, we don't have a cruel thought in our mind. We have thoughts of compassion, of wanting to be free from suffering. And this is the three aspects of the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right intention, Sammasankappa. So we practice these every time we come to meditate. This is part of the wisdom aspect of the path. We want to develop some discernment. How should we use our mind? We want to use it to practice renunciation, to practice love, to practice compassion. And this right intention is the foundation of our meditation practice. We sit with this renunciation. We want to be here. We want to meditate. So this is really helpful, right? We decide now is the time for meditation. And when you've made that decision, you want to be there. You don't want to be doing any of those other things. This is what renunciation is, this voluntary giving up. So when you come to sit, just having that intention, I'm going to be here for the next 20 minutes. And this is what I'm going to be doing. This is all that matters right now, meditation. And this will be a very powerful way for you to feel like you can be here present, not wanting to be doing all those other things that are possible. And looking around, here you are now. You've given up so much, right, to be here. You've given up the delights of Harris Park and all the food that's out there, all the entertainment, all the lights and activity. You've given up something to be here. So you're already practicing this right intention of renunciation. And looking around, you know, we have so many good friends here in this room and online. We can feel a sense of love for all the people who are here. And we're all here coming together to practice meditation in order to be free from suffering. We have so much compassion for ourselves and compassion for other beings. So these right intentions are a good way to start off the practice of meditation. We've already had our minds inspired by the going for refuge and the practice of the inner cities. All of these things are working together to help us in our process of meditation. And remember that all of this starts way before we even sit down. We want to be living a good life, a life full of ethics, kindness to others, practicing good bodily behavior, good speech, good thoughts. And then when it comes to sit, we're already in the right place. We practice the anusatis, we remember the importance of right intention. And all these things will help us to develop the peace and happiness that comes from meditation. So that's what we're going to do now. We're going to do 20 minutes of meditation. Then we're going to have a little break. And I'm going to guide the meditation. And maybe you can see some of the things that I've talked about already in the instructions. It's good to do pretty much the same sort of beginning to your practice when you come to meditate. This conditions the mind in the right way, helps you become more acquainted with the process of your meditation so that you can understand what causes create the right conditions for practice and what things you want to let go of that impede progress on the path. And so having some insight into your practice, understanding the process is very important to develop in your meditation. So let's take a comfortable posture, something that works for you. And we begin just by making sure that we're feeling good. So take a few moments to set up your posture and find that comfortable spot where the body is alert but soft, not too stiff. You want to be upright but not uptight. And then you can close your eyes, and already we've made a big change. Just by closing your eyes, we've shut off some sensory input from the outside world. And so we're leaving that world outside behind now. We've decided this is the time for meditation. And so we can let go of the world beyond this room. Just leave it there. It'll be there for you later. But for now, I'm going to be here. Now, in this place. So you let go of the day, let go of the week, all the busyness, all of the activities. You just leave them now in the past. Sure, there'll be some echoes, some resonance. We don't get involved. We can let go of all of those things, leaving them in the past where they belong. And we're not planning the future. Future is uncertain. We're here now. We can leave the future in the future. So we let go of thinking, planning for the future. And so by letting go of the past and letting go of the future, we can be here. We can be now, present. We can be aware. We can relax. We can let go. We can let go of all the tension and tightness that we've been storing in this body. You feel your body sitting here. Can you see the tension, tightness lingering? We can let go of this tension, let go of this tightness. Consciously relaxing. And so let go of the tightness and tension in your face. Allow your forehead to become smooth and soft, not worried, not stressed, soft. Allow those eyes to rest. Allow the face to soften and relax. Unclench your jaw. Already. Becoming more soft, more relaxed, already starting to feel good. Why don't you allow yourself a little smile? Allow yourself that feeling of love in your heart. I'm here now. I'm meditating. Good. Then allow the shoulders to relax and feel the arms becoming soft. Relaxing down to the arms, allow the tightness and tension to drain away through the fingers. And letting go of the back of the body, feeling the spine softening, feeling all the muscles releasing, letting go of tension, letting go of tightness, relaxing the entire back of the body. And coming to the front of your body, relaxing all the bones, all the muscles of the chest. Allowing even the heart, even the lungs to soften. And you let go of any tension lingering in the abdomen, relaxing deep inside. Moving down through the hips, relaxing, feeling the heaviness in the buttocks, allow the legs to soften and relax, letting go of the knees, releasing any tension in the legs all the way down to the feet. Any tightness any tension draining away. And now the whole body is relaxed and comfortable. Maybe you notice that where previously there was tightness and tension, by letting go, now there is more comfort, more ease. And that it feels good to let go. And when the body is relaxed, the mind naturally becomes more calm, more peaceful, all by itself. Sure, thoughts come and go, but we don't get involved. We let go just as we released those muscles. We let go of the thoughts. And it feels good to let go. And when the body is relaxed, and when the mind is calm and peaceful, the breath appears all by itself. And it's natural to become mindful of this breath. We see the breath coming in. We see the breath going out. And we naturally want to stay with this beautiful breath. So soothing, so calming, deeply nourishing. And so for the next few minutes, relaxing the body, or letting go of the thoughts, or watching the breath, being here, now, aware, relaxed, and peaceful. Now we're coming towards the end of this short session. This is our chance to review, to understand what just happened. You can ask yourself, how am I feeling now? Is it different from when I began? Why? What happened? Were you able to relax the body? How did that feel? Were you able to get some peace and calm? Or was that difficult? Were you able to see the breath? How was that? And so in this way, by reflecting and reviewing, we begin to understand the process of our practice. We can develop wisdom about the causes and conditions that lead to wholesome mind states. And we can see how we can let go of unwholesome mind states. We can move from suffering to happiness by letting go. And so hopefully you're feeling more relaxed and calm, so we can dedicate the merit of all this good practice we've done, reciting the Namo Tassa, going for refuge, reciting the Anusatis, and practicing meditation. We can dedicate the merit of all these good actions to the benefit of all living beings, wishing may all beings hear the Dhamma, may all beings grow in wisdom, and may all beings achieve Nibbana. Very good. So let's have a short break. We'll have a 10-minute break and we'll come back and we'll have a talk about meditation. So see you shortly. Okay, so I hope you had a nice little stretch. We had some conversations here. I'd love to keep talking with you, but we have to keep going with this format that we've got going on here. So I don't want to leave all these people online just at their own devices. Who knows what they'll get up to, hey? Because that's the trouble with our mind. That's why that question that I asked at the beginning, is there a correct way to meditate? That's an important question to understand. It's very tempting, especially today, when we have this perception that everyone's an expert or that there's no right way of doing anything, or maybe an idea that often comes from certain Buddhist traditions that you should do nothing, have a not knowing mind. And we might believe that the not knowing mind is the way to find some wisdom that is already existing within us. However, you know, I don't know if you can really trust this approach. I know that my mind, when it wasn't trained, was not very trustworthy. And when we talk about citta bhavana, about mental development, we're actually talking about a training. We have instructions to follow. We have a path to follow. And we're training the mind. We're developing the mind. And this is a technique. This is an approach that was carefully laid out by the Buddha. It wasn't something that he wanted to leave up to chance for his followers, right? He was approached all the time by lay people and also monastics, also people from other spiritual traditions who would say to him, oh, I have this question about this. And the Buddha would say, very good that you have this question that you've asked. You know, it's very confusing about these things. It's good that you've asked. It's good that you have a doubt. It's good that you don't know. And this is how I would do it, says the Buddha. Or he would have monks come up to him that had been having conversations with wanderers from other sects, and they would ask the monks questions, and the monks wouldn't be able to respond. And the Buddha, they'd go to the Buddha afterwards and they'd say, oh, you know, these people said this to us and we didn't know how to respond. And the Buddha would say, it's not surprising that you don't know how to respond. Who else would know the answer but me, the Buddha, not me? And he said, who else in this world full of its maras and brahmins and its, you know, all of the many different people in this world system would know the answer to these questions unless they had discovered it for themselves or had been taught it by another? And so this path that he outlined is a very rich path, and we need to actually inquire. We need to find out what was taught, and we need to hear from many people how to practice. And slowly over time, our mind becomes more and more familiar with this approach, and we see that we are actually developing our mind and that it is difficult. We can't leave our mind to its own devices. Have you noticed what happens when you leave your mind to its own devices? It just naturally follows its inclinations, its habits. It just naturally goes, because of habit, to the defilements. And these, of course, don't lead to good results. These lead to suffering. And so it's important to remember that meditation is a process and that it's part of our spiritual practice. It's not something that is done entirely in isolation. We can't come here for 20 minutes a week to practice meditation and think that somehow we're going to radically change our mind or our life. It just doesn't work like that. So if you've just joined the session, just check to make sure that your microphone is off. It doesn't work like that, that we can somehow magically transform our mind with a mere 20 minutes of practice a week or a month or whatever it is you're doing. And sometimes it may not be possible to radically transform your mind even practicing an hour or 2 hours a day. Progress can be quite slow. That's why it's really good if you ever have the opportunity to actually see what the mind is capable of, to go and do a retreat. And then that habit pattern of the mind, which you all saw in the 20 minutes that we just did, you're all so painfully aware of, that habit pattern has the opportunity to diminish and to change. And when we're on retreat, eventually you know, usually just before you go, the mind will have settled enough that you start to see these positive states that arise once those unwholesome, unhelpful states have started to be let go and have settled a bit. Often that's the most dangerous part of the retreat, of course, because your mind is so powerful and clear that you start to think that you should use it for really boring things, like thinking about work problems or solving that relationship crisis or planning the future. And then, of course, what happens is the process, those causes and conditions that we carefully laid down in place, get sabotaged by us. And we use the power of the mind for really banal, boring, uninteresting, everyday things. And not only do we turn the mind away from that renunciation that we've been practicing of the outside world and developing that internal world, not only do we turn the mind away from that internal world for these external things, but we actually cut out the future growth of that meditation by that sabotaging. The things that led us to that good place, we reject for a lower form of happiness. And then we don't get the chance to become even deeper in our practice. And so this is something to be aware of, even in our daily practice sessions, that, you know, there's a moment in our practice where we're tempted, having found some peace, having found some calm, to start using the mind to think. And so this, of course, limits the depth to which we can practice our meditation, because we cut off the causes and conditions that allow for growth. So it's important to be aware of that. And it's important to also be aware of how we're behaving outside of our meditation practice. If we're only meditating for 20 minutes a week, that means there's a lot of time that is not meditation time. And that is actually where we need to put a lot of our emphasis. That's where we need to practice a lot of care. We need to really make sure that we're living well, that we're practicing an ethical life, that we're following the precepts or whatever ethical system you hold dear, and that you're consciously improving your life, being a good person, making sure that you're practicing ethics, being kind, being generous. These are the kinds of causes and conditions that will make your meditation sit even better. These are the causes and conditions that will lead the mind to feel like there's no regret or remorse when it comes to sit. You're not hankering for the world outside. You're not worried about that person you spoke badly to. You're not tempted by these worldly things. You're living a good life and you feel like it's good to sit and meditate. I'm always reminded of the urgent duties that a farmer has, according to the Buddha, and that's three urgent duties that we have if we want to develop the higher training in ethics, the higher training in the mind, and the higher training in wisdom. If we want to develop on the path, we need to make sure that we've got these three urgent duties done as part of our life. So the first urgent duty of a farmer and the first urgent duty of us as meditators, as spiritual people, is to make sure that that ethical framework is developed. And so the Buddha compares this to the work of a farmer who needs to till the field to prepare the soil, right? You need to prepare the soil. That's our ethics. This is the ground of our practice. When we have strong ethics, our practice can flourish. We're preparing this ground by making sure that we're doing good actions of body, speech, and mind, and that we're not doing bad actions of body, speech, and mind. So in this way, we prepare the soil. And then the next thing is we plant the seed. So planting the seed is developing the mind. This is our meditation practice. This is reflecting upon our meditation, understanding the phenomena that occur in our mind. So this is the seed that gets planted. So we need to prepare the soil, plant the seed, and then we need to irrigate that seed to provide water. And this is wisdom. This is the wisdom that nourishes our meditation, that drenches into that soil, that causes the plant to grow. And the Buddha said that we need to do these three urgent duties of practicing ethical conduct, developing the mind, and developing wisdom by hearing the Dharma, speaking to teachers, understanding causes and effects, developing discernment. We need to do these three urgent duties. But even then, like that farmer who's put all those causes and conditions into place, even then we can't force anything. We can't rush anything. Results will come. It's only natural that a seed that is planted in well-tilled soil, watered at the right time, it's only natural that that plant will grow. In the same way, it's only natural that when we have good ethical conduct, when we have developed our mind and understood our experiences with some wisdom, it's only natural that that plant will grow. But we can't force it. We can't will it to happen. We can't make it happen. It needs to happen of its own natural development. And so this is an important thing to understand in our spiritual practice, that it's very easy to want to get good results right now, to go on retreat and try to force a really wonderful experience. But it doesn't work like that. The secret ingredient in our spiritual life is time. And it's time that we seem to have less of than what we need, right? No matter how much time we have, it's always too little. And the time that you have in your life for your spiritual practice is probably too little as well. I feel the same. I remember someone saying something to me once. They said, "Oh, you have so much more time than me." And I was like, "No, I don't. We all get exactly the same amount of time. It's what we do with it that matters." And so if we think about it in this way, the time that we have to practice our spiritual practice should be a priority for us, because reflecting more broadly, our time is running out. Your time is running out. So how are you living your life? What are you doing with your meditation practice? What are you doing with the rest of your life? How are you living? So we want to think like this, because it's easy to think of our spiritual practice as something that we leave last in our life, something that we kind of will get to when all those other things are done. But all those other things that would prevent you from getting to the cushion, right? All those other things get in the way. So instead of putting our spiritual practice last at the kind of the bottom of the list, we should put it first. And then we're giving it priority, the priority that it deserves. And then we can start to see some real transformation in our life. If you keep on leaving things to the end of the list that you never get to, then you'll never get the benefits and results that come from practicing. So it's really important to prioritize your spiritual practice. That doesn't mean that you have to give up everything and become a nun or a monk. It doesn't mean that you have to spend all your day in meditation. It means that we start to think differently about our spiritual practice. It's not that hobby that we do at the end of the week is not something peripheral. It's something that's truly at the center of our life. And that means that you can make even very small changes in your life that matter. It's changing the perspective a little by understanding today I wake up, I'm going to practice good ethical conduct all day. I'm going to try to make sure that my speech is kind, that I don't tell a lie, that I practice something like a small act of generosity. And then you use these little moments in your life, your everyday life, not your special meditation time, your everyday life, the bulk of your time. You use that time powerfully. You use it in a way that creates the right causes and conditions for non-regret and for joy. So you do something nice. You give your seat up on the train. That's a spiritual practice. You take some cupcakes to the office. That's spiritual, right? That's part of our practice. You don't kill the cockroach. That's part of your practice. And so when we think like this, it transforms our everyday experience from being not part of our spiritual practice to being part of our spiritual practice. It's a really important thing. I think when you start to do this, you can change the way you perceive your spiritual life. And by constantly irrigating your field with spiritual teachings or spiritual reflections like kindness or generosity, by constantly doing this, your plant has more chances of growth because it's getting the wisdom, the watering that it needs. And so this process that this plant needs to go through is a good way for us to also think about our meditation practice, that our meditation practice is not discrete in that it's not separate. It's not separated from our life. It's a part of our life. What happens before you get to the meditation cushion impacts what happens on the meditation cushion, right? You see all of these things, all the activity that you've done, all of the stress, all of the tension, all of the problems, all of the joys, all of the happiness, all of that comes with you to the cushion. It's not separate from the life that you live on the cushion. It influences what happens on the cushion. And that's why it's so important to have no regret in your mind when you come to sit. Firstly, you don't want to regret bad behavior that hurt others. That's really get a stick in your mind. It's horrible. Oh, I wish I hadn't said that. Or why am I such an angry person? You're going to sit there with that mind. Or if you're really interested in all of the pleasures of the world, then those things are going to stop you from feeling present on the cushion, prevent you from getting there. But then once you're there, they're going to get you up again pretty soon, right? Those are the things that draw you out of your practice. So we have this, these two things that impact the mind. And the Buddha said that we should be really careful with our thoughts. Before he became an enlightened being, when he was a bodhisattva, he divided his thoughts into two categories. He divided them into those thoughts of which we can identify, the ones that I mentioned earlier, as being thoughts of right intention, renunciation, non-ill will, and non-harm. These are wholesome thoughts. The opposite, the unwholesome thoughts, are thoughts of sensory experiences, sense desire, and ill will, and harm or cruel thoughts. These are the unwholesome thoughts. So he divided his thoughts into these two categories, unwholesome, wholesome. And the image that he gives about what happens in the mind is really beautiful. It's images of a cow and a cow herd, a cow herd and his herd of cows, or her herd of cows. It's quite a lot of H's and cows. And the image that he gives about those unwholesome thoughts, those thoughts of sensory desire, of ill will and of cruelty, the image he gives is of a field that is full of grain, beautiful, rich field at the end of the growth season, just before the harvest. And there's a cow herd coming along. She has many cows. Her job is to make sure that those cows don't go off and graze in that field, because if they do, she'll get in trouble, right? She'll get punished. Those cows will eat all of the farmer's crop. And this is what happens when we just let our mind wander to those unwholesome thoughts. It munches all of the grain. It loves it. It loves eating. You know, cows, they just eat and eat and eat. And that's what they'll do. And that's what your mind does. Have you seen it? Thought of ill will comes into the mind. Just a tiny little thought came from somewhere. And then it grows and grows and grows, and it becomes big. And then it's all the mind can see. All of the work that you were doing beforehand disappears, and those cows are having a wonderful feast. And so the Buddha said that we should be careful. We should be gently tapping the mind to keep it away from munching on those bad thoughts. Like a cow herd gently taps the cows to keep them in line, keep them away from the crops. So we need some strategies, like having some mindfulness, having sense restraint, some wisdom, understanding. We need a bit of sati sampajanya, a bit of yoniso manisakara, this wise attention. We need this to help us in our practice. So we need to not just let the mind stray, hoping that eventually it will find a good place. Instead, we need to carefully consider how we're using our mind when we come to meditate. And we need to have some ability to identify what's going on and some skills to deal with it. And so that's us gently tapping our mind, like the cow herd gently taps the cows, to make sure that the mind isn't running off to munch on all those unwholesome thoughts. When we have wholesome thoughts, thoughts of renunciation, of letting go, thoughts of love and compassion, when we have these kinds of thoughts, the mind can quite happily stray to these thoughts and it's no problem. The image that he gives is that same cow herd, because the crops have been harvested, there's nothing for the cows to munch. And so the cow herd can just sit and relax under a tree in the shade. And the cows can wander wherever they want. The cow herd won't get in trouble. And so this is, for us, that time in meditation where our mind is full of good thoughts. We can relax. We don't need to do anything at that time. But the Buddha said, you know, it's easy to think about thoughts over and over again that are lovely and positive and nice, like renunciation, love or compassion. But eventually the mind gets tired and the body gets tired. And so eventually he said we should develop samadhi. So this is a deeper state of meditation where the body and the mind are unified. So this shows that there's a process, right? that it's not just doing one thing. That meditation is about having some wisdom, that we need to know what to do at the right time. That there are different strategies that we need for different parts of our meditation. And this, for many people, it seems, is like a bit of news, that there's not one way to meditate, that you can't just say to someone, this is how you meditate, because the mind is a multifaceted, many splendid and quite chaotic thing. It's changing all the time. It doesn't stay the same. The way you deal with it will require different approaches. So you can't say do anything else in your life, I imagine, with only one instruction. You can't just drive a car and never make a turn. You can't just drive a car and never need to slow down or speed up. You need to have a sense of what you're doing, what the purpose is that you're doing. If you're going to a destination, you'll need to turn left. You'll need to slow down. You'll need to stop. You'll need to go. And so when it comes to meditation, we're not just doing nothing. We need to be skillful about how we work with our mind. And many people have never heard these kinds of approaches. Many people have never allowed themselves or given themselves permission to actually work with their mind. They just sit there and the mind kind of happens to them, right? As if it's not their mind, as if they're not involved somehow, as if these thoughts are just happening to you. In some way, this is true, that it's just the result of causes and conditions, of habits. It's just the result of all your past actions. This is what's going on right now for you. It's all of that stuff that's come before. And so in a certain way, it's happening to you, but we're always, of course, responding to these things and creating more trouble for ourselves if we're not careful. And so it's good to know that you're allowed to be involved in your meditation practice. And certainly when we read the suttas, we see that the Buddha encouraged people to work with the mind in different ways at different times. When the mind needs to be uplifted and given some emotional support that nourishes the mind, that wants the mind to stay and be happy to meditate, he recommended things like the anusatis, to inspire the mind, to give it joy, to make it present. It's contemplating things like recollecting your generosity or recollecting your ethical conduct. This brings your life from outside your meditation practice into your meditation practice, and it amplifies the goodness that is contained in those actions. Being generous has good results for you. You experience joy because of your generosity. It echoes in your mind. It fills the heart with joy. And from that joy, your meditation can deepen and develop. That joy quickly becomes rapture, pity. And that pity becomes deeper still, becomes a beautiful bodily tranquility, the mind being drawn inwards. And then you get this beautiful bliss, this sukha that comes. And then that sukha draws the mind deeper and deeper into samadhi. And from that samadhi, you develop wisdom, seeing clearly nature of reality. And from that comes dispassion, and from that comes turning away, then dispassion, and then of course we can eventually go all the way to freedom. And this comes from an act of generosity in your everyday life, right? So this is how we work with the mind in meditation. But it's a process. So we need to know when to inspire the mind, when to develop joy in the mind, and when to just chill out and do nothing. So there's different ways that we need to approach it. Not just one way to approach your meditation. So we need to develop some skills. We need to develop some tools. We need to know what's happening and how to respond. There's a couple of suttas I really like. One of them is the sutta about the goldsmith, which is in the Anguttara Nikaya 3s. Many of you will have heard that sutta about how gold has, there's the panner. Do you know the panner? The gold panner? It's like the person who's collecting the gold from the river needs to wash the gold to remove the impurities. So that's a good sutta, yeah? It talks about a process of purification. You get rid of the gross impurities first, like your bad ethical behavior and conduct, your bad speech, bad actions. Get rid of that, slightly purer. And then you've got these other things, the hindrances to work with. Once you get rid of them, you've got even finer, very subtle hindrances like conceit and self-view. The sutta after that is the sutta about the goldsmith. And this sutta talks about meditation as a process. And it describes that there's different things that we need to do at different times. So in this sutta, there's a goldsmith working. So they need to create the fire to melt the gold. They need to pump the bellows to get the oxygen into the fire. And that makes it more active, right? So they fan the bellows. Sometimes, though, they'll need to cool the fire down or cool the gold down, so they'll sprinkle water on it. And other times, they'll need to just do nothing and let the process have its way. And so the Buddha said, you know, when there's these really strong things like restlessness in the mind, then we should sprinkle some water on our mind to cool it down, right? When it's getting agitated, we need to bring it back to a sense of peace and calm. And there's other times when there's not enough energy in the mind, then we'll need to bring some energy into the mind. So we need to pump those bellows, we need to fan the mind, develop that energy back, you know. Sometimes it'll be at the very beginning of the practice, maybe we'll need to bring some energy to play. And then there's other times where we should do nothing and just stand and observe and just watch, allow this process to unfold of its own accord, just like that plant that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk that needs to grow and develop all by itself, as long as the causes and conditions are in place. You know, we water it when we need to. We don't water it when we don't need to. So in the same way, you know, when we're a goldsmith, we know how to get the gold, right? And when you think about it, it's so simple. It's like, yeah, when my mind's really sluggish, should I just let it be? When I've got a lot of anger in my mind, should I just let it sit there? Or should I do something with it? So there'd be some times in our meditation practice where it's appropriate to do something with it, and there'll be some times when it might not be appropriate to move the mind too much. And wisdom should be knowing the difference, right? But especially if we're only practicing for 20 minutes a week, we want to be really careful that we're using that time wisely, that we're not just allowing the mind to stray off into unwholesome states, because often we'll come to sit and that hindrance will be our entire meditation session. That's it for us, right? By doing nothing, we've allowed ourselves to sit there with a hindrance of the mind for the entire session. We haven't learnt then how to work with the mind. That's been our experience. And so if we're wise, we can actually see these things coming avoid them if possible, or if they arise, we understand this is a hindrance. This has so many drawbacks, the Buddha said. I don't want to get involved with this hindrance. And with some wisdom there, understanding the drawbacks, we let it go. It's not a forceful letting go. It's a very gentle release. Just like we released the muscles in our body for our meditation, just like we didn't get involved with those thoughts, just letting go allows for those things to disappear. But we need to have the wisdom to understand the difference between a wholesome mind state and an unwholesome mind state. Sometimes it's good actually to sit with a hindrance for a little while and see the torture it gives us, right? I mean, it's one thing to be in the grip of a hindrance and not be aware of it. It's another thing to be observing that hindrance. At least we're making some movement towards some wisdom, right? We're investigating the Dhamma. We're seeing what's going on, and we've got enough mindfulness to do that. And then when we do that, we can see, oh, actually, this is not very pleasant at all. I don't want this in my mind. It doesn't lead to any goodness. And this will help us understand why we want to avoid them. At other times, when we're not aware enough, where we don't have enough mindfulness, we're not investigating in the right way, or we don't understand, we're ignorant. When we've got a mind like that, then we can't appreciate just how bad these states are for us. And that's why I say it's so important to understand that we're training the mind, that we want to move away from unwholesome states to wholesome states, that we are actually developing our mind through our practice. So it's good to be aware that this is the purpose, right? This is the point of our practice. We're trying to develop the mind. This is a training. It will require some effort. But we need to be reflective about how we work. And so we can develop the kind of practice which looks at itself, that we're involved in the stuff that comes before we get to sit on the cushion, you know, our life, we're involved in that. That's where we can do a lot of work in our spiritual practice. And then when we sit down, we're a part of that practice too. We're involved. And then when we finish the session, when we start to reflect upon what just happened, when we review, we're involved. We do this review to investigate what works, what leads to peace, what leads to wholesome states. And we understand what leads to unwholesome states. Or we see, what did I let go of in my practice? What was I holding on to? What was allowing me to progress, and what was holding me back? So we're involved. And then if we're really smart, if we've really got some wisdom, then we take that knowledge that we've learned in our meditation, when our mind has been so clear and so sharp, we take that knowledge and we apply it to our life. We don't forget it. It matters to us. It helps guide us in our life. And so when we see, oh, this hindrance of anger is present and disrupts my mind, causes me suffering, creates unwholesome states and agitates my mind so much, when we see that clearly in our meditation practice, when we've seen it with wisdom, we don't want that in our life. We don't want to bring that anger back into our life. And so we try to avoid becoming angry. And so in this way, we start to really understand how to develop the right causes that lead to good results, both before our practice and through our practice and into our life, so that we can have, you know, more peace in our non-meditation life too, more calm, better interactions with our friends and family and colleagues. And we can start to bring that joy that we develop in our meditation, that happiness, that peace, that calm, all those beautiful, good, wholesome, nourishing states that are so nice to experience, so blissful to have. We bring those from our meditation practice into our life. It's only natural that when you condition the mind to experience and enjoy these joyful, blissful, happy states, it's only natural that becoming familiar with that, those kinds of experiences will carry over into your non-meditation time. And so in this way, we have this beautiful process, this really special way to see how the mind actually works and how we can nourish it and how it can benefit us in our life and our practice. So it's a short talk about the meditation process and how we can include it as reflective practitioners as part of our spiritual journey. So I hope it's been of some benefit to you. It's about 9:15. I don't know if there's any questions you'd like to ask. Please feel free if you want. Yes.
You mentioned some benefit that you might have gotten from the meditation, like something you've seen, and then applying it back into your life.
Right?
I remember a few years ago, I sort of clearly saw that when I get angry, it actually hurts me. But I can't remember what made me come to that conclusion at that time. Like, it's like a memory. Like, I remember I saw it clearly, but I can't remember the details now.
So the question was about how once someone recognized that they had anger and they saw that it hurts them, and so you're asking, like, you can't remember the details, but you still have this knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So we've got to apply the knowledge. I think I remember an example, this idea of, you know, like the Buddha is like a doctor, right? So we need to heed the wisdom of an expert. And if a doctor gives you a prescription, then you better take it to the chemist and get the medicine. You don't just read the prescription. And so similarly, like if we have this flash of wisdom, anger hurts me, then you don't just stop there. That's just the very first step. It's like the bare minimum that's going to help you. It'll help you. This recognition is so powerful because beforehand you didn't know that. You might have known it intellectually, but you hadn't experienced it for yourself. So when you experience it for yourself, then, you know, it should matter more to you. You're not relying upon the wisdom of others. You're relying upon your own wisdom. And so if you see it for yourself, then you should make sure you notice, right, and take it to heart. And you give yourself a little talking to from time to time. I give myself a little talking to. A calico. That way leads to trouble. And in the Dvaita-Vitaka Sutta that I mentioned before, where the Buddha is comprehending the draw, when the Buddha, before he was a Buddha, when he was still unenlightened, like us, when he was contemplating those mind states, he was contemplating the drawbacks. So this is something that we need to understand, this is something that will help us. This is where wisdom can be found, by contemplating the drawbacks of those mind states. And he said, it doesn't lead to happiness for me. It doesn't lead to happiness for others. So it leads to suffering for myself and for others. It leads to suffering for both myself and others. It leads away from wisdom. It causes vexation, and it doesn't lead to nirvana. So, like, give yourself a little talking to. If your mind is full of anger, then you're not really doing a lot of meditation anyway. Better to give yourself a quick talking to and then return to the object of meditation, so that you're working skillfully. It's tempting sometimes, especially if you've heard certain teachers talk about practice, like you should just do nothing the whole time, then it's tempting just to sit there with that. We're slow learners, right? You know, eventually the mind, you think, if the mind was watching enough, you'd see the drawbacks of these kinds of things. But the mind is a very slow learner. And so, you know, you can sit there the whole hour and still not learn, right? So we need to learn. We need to develop wisdom. And that wisdom comes from seeing those things and understanding, this is bad for me. So if it's bad for you, only a fool would repeat it. But we're fools. And we're conditioned. And we're habitual. What we actually need to do is to unpick some of that conditioning, drop thread by thread, whatever the metaphor should be, and it's slow and it takes time. So every time it happens, remind yourself, this is a hindrance. And eventually what happens over time is, because we're training the mind, what happens over time is the mind learns. Little by little by little. And it learns really quickly. So that then when these things are coming, you know they're coming before they're present. And you know, I don't want to get involved in that. That's a hindrance. So this is how we practice right effort. You know, this effort to prevent unwholesome states, to abandon unwholesome states, to cultivate positive states and to maintain them. So we can practice in this way. You know, this is what we're doing as part of our meditation. But that's a topic for another time. Yes.
I have another question. You spoke about fanning the mind when it's like energy. What sort of tool can we use? Because I tend to fall asleep every time again. It goes into a more relaxed, and then falls asleep. And then on the flip side, when I'm anxious and I can't sleep and like there's fear or anxiety, then I cannot meditate, I cannot focus. So how do we...
Yeah, sure. So the question's about the sluggish mind, the dullness and drowsiness, and how to deal with that. Or when you've got too much restlessness and too much anxiety, how to deal with that. So the answer is to develop the bojangas, the factors of enlightenment, and to know which ones are appropriate to use at the time. So whenever we talk about hindrances, usually we need to talk about hindrances are bad. So it's one thing to just talk about the bad stuff, but actually we need to understand the good stuff that helps us to develop. And so the hindrances are the bad and the factors of enlightenment are the good. So they're things like, does anyone know them? Mindfulness. Does anyone know what's next? Investigation of the dhammas, investigation of principles, energy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, and upekkha, equanimity. So these are the seven factors of enlightenment, which I won't go into right now. But the Buddha gives a beautiful example of wanting to fan a fire to bring up more heat in the fire. And so he says, when you want more fire, you don't put water and wet wood or cow dung onto the fire. Why? You want fire, but you're going to put it out if you put those things on it, right? So similarly, if you want to put out a fire, then you would put water, sand, wet wood, cow dung onto it, right? You get it? So we need to know what is going to fuel the fire and what is going to put it out. So if you have a sluggish mind, then you're going to need to bring some energy into the mind. So that's the time to develop the Bojangas, the seven factors of enlightenment, of investigation, seeing what's going on. If you think you're tired, then you know you should really look at what's going on. What's going on is we're going to die very soon. Every moment, that should be enough of a start. And then, so you develop investigation, you develop pity, rapture, and you develop energy. So investigation, energy, and rapture are what you should develop at that time when the mind is sluggish. And when the mind is overexcited, you should develop the pacifying Bojangas, pacifying, tranquilizing Bojangas, which are tranquility and bliss and equanimity, samadhi. So what was left out? So I just say it again, pity, tranquility and samadhi. Of course, pity and sukha often come together, pity and bliss, rapture and bliss. So that's when you should develop the pacifying qualities, when you've got too much excitement in the mind. And what's left out? Mindfulness, which is always useful, the Buddha says. So we have to be mindful, we have to know what's going on, we have to know how to respond. If the mind is really tired, then we try to energize it somehow. You might visualize a light, you might open your eyes, might stand up, you might remember all of the Dharma that you've ever heard before. You might remember future perils, that you could be dead with the next breath. Pull your ears. These are ways that the Buddha recommended avoiding a sluggish mind. Or if the mind is really anxious or overexcited, then you pacify the mind. So you use the breath, calms you down, makes you feel so good and peaceful, and brings the mind back to this stableness. Or you just observe it and you work with this idea of equanimity, just sitting back, not getting too involved, and hopefully eventually it will calm down. So these are some ways that you can work with those minds. And so that's why we understand the hindrances, and we also understand the factors of enlightenment. It's getting a bit late. So people are starting to want to go, I think. So perhaps we'll finish up there unless there's no more questions. Thanks, Tom, for reminding us about tomorrow's talk. So I'm giving a talk tomorrow on the end. So it's called Buddhism and the Symbiocene. Did I say that correctly? Symbiocene. So it's about how we can live in harmony, in a symbiotic relationship with our planet, with the environment, how we cannot be a parasite, but how we can actually be in harmony with the planet. And so the link's in the chat. I think the link's also on the Lokanta Vihara website. And next weekend, do you know what's happening next weekend? Next weekend is the Metta Festival, which is run by our friends at the Metta Center. They're having a festival in Bankstown on Saturday the 18th of June from 3 to 7 p.m. And it is an extravaganza of dance, culture, stalls, and all the money that's raised goes to help support the Metta Center. So if you can get along to that, you'll find information on the Metta Center website. And yeah, it sounds like fun. Okay. Take care, everybody. Have a very good week. I think I'll be back next week. Bhante Sujata will be away, and I look forward to seeing you then. Take care.
Thank you, Bhante. Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.